This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
Just about any teacher will tell you that dealing with teenagers for a living can range from extremely rewarding to nightmarish. But don't blame or credit the child. It's all on the child's brain.
There's something about the period of life of adolescence that makes the brain particularly vulnerable to developing mental health problems.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll learn how the constantly changing brain of teenagers makes them who they are, eventually. We'll also hear the story of a Massachusetts woman whose brain underwent changes due to a childhood trauma and the care that was needed to get her life back. And we'll spend an academic minute finding out just who is more likely to develop PTSD. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. Adolescents are often stereotyped as moody, lazy, untrustworthy, even violent. It's strangely acceptable to mock and demonize teenagers. And until recently, stereotypically moody teenage behavior was put down to raging hormones and changes in their social life. But with the help of advanced brain scanning technology, scientists have for the first time been able to study how the physiological mechanisms that develop in the adolescent years determine our sense of who we are, our sense of self. Sarah Jane Blakemore is a professor of cognitive neuroscience at University College London. In her book, Inventing Ourselves, The Secret Life of the Teenage Brain, she explains precisely what's going on in the complex and fascinating brains of teenagers. She spoke about her book with The Best of Our Knowledge's Joe Donahue, who asked why she took on the topic of the teenage brain.
I was doing some research on mental illness. And I learned that most mental illnesses like depression and anxiety and eating schizophrenia first start during adolescence, which is what led me initially to decide to study the development of the teenage brain to find out what's going on.
I guess I find it interesting that mental illness will somehow bring you in the same quarters of a teenage brain.
Yes, but what we know for sure is that 3/4 of all mental illnesses start in adolescence. So there's something about the period of life of adolescence that makes the brain particularly vulnerable to developing mental health problems.
My understanding is that we're getting to know a lot more about the brain overall. But when it comes to the teenage brain, great strides there as well, I assume.
Yeah, so 20 years ago, we knew almost nothing about how the human brain develops during the teenage years. In fact, the dogma back then was that it didn't develop at all after childhood. That's what I was taught when I was doing my undergraduate degree. But in the last 15 or 20 years, many different studies around the world have scanned the living human brain during childhood and throughout adolescence and shown that, contrary to what I was taught 20 years ago, the brain, in fact, continues to develop right throughout childhood, throughout the teenage years and into the 20s. And it undergoes really substantial, big, protracted changes.
We so often hear about social pressures and, of course, hormones that have a lot to do with the way that adolescents behave. You write about it in the book, though, and say that this is actually the development of the brain.
Yeah, so again, 20 years ago, those kinds of stereotypical teenage behaviors that we associate adolescents with, like risk-taking and impulsivity and self-consciousness and being influenced by their friends, they were all put down to hormones, increases in sex hormones at puberty, and also social changes like moving schools from going from small schools to big secondary schools and middle schools. And that's just because we didn't know back then anything about how the brain develops. But we now know that in addition to those hormonal changes and social changes, the brain is undergoing large amounts of development in brain regions that are involved in things like decision-making and planning and risk-taking and self-awareness and social understanding. So that adds a part of the jigsaw puzzle in understanding teenage typical behavior.
So when it comes to your political beliefs or your moral beliefs or who you like to listen to on the radio, this is when that gets fully developed.
Well, it's when those kind of things start to become really important. Because if you think about what is adolescence for, you know, think back about your own teenage years. This is when your sense of kind of who you are, your self-identity, and particularly how other people see you, takes on a step change in importance. It suddenly becomes really important to define yourself to other people. So that's why we become much more interested in our what fashion we wear, our music taste, what peer group we're hanging out with. And, as you said, things like our moral beliefs and our political beliefs take on a sudden increase in importance during the teenage years because that's what defines us to other people.
You write in the book about understanding the development of the social brain during this time, during adolescence, has real implications for legal and education policy and, of course, for parents of the giving us an idea of what the best time is to do various things and teach various things in an adolescent's life.
Yes. This is a very young field of science, so there aren't too many conclusions that we can draw yet for the classroom, but we can certainly conclude that it's really useful. A lot of teachers and parents and even teenagers themselves find it useful to understand more about how the brain changes in adolescence and to understand why certain behaviors are often seen in adolescence, like risk-taking and impulsivity and those kinds of behaviors. So I think you know, my main kind of general point would be that it's empowering for young people and the people who teach them and look after them to understand more about teen brain development. And then there are a few specific findings from neuroscience that I think probably do have quite strong implications for education, like, for example, the finding that in adolescence, the brain's circadian rhythm, so the body clock, shifts by about 2 hours so that teenagers are no longer ready to go to sleep in the evening, early in the evening, and they're also not ready to get up in the morning. And that's not because they're lazy, which is, I think is, you know, kind of stereotype of teenagers, but it's because for biological reasons, the sleep-inducing hormone melatonin is produced a couple of hours later during the teenage years than it is in childhood or adulthood. So that obviously has implications for what time children are expected to go to school in the morning.
One of the things that I learned in your book, the brain, and tell me if I'm right on this, if I understand this correctly, is that the brain continues to develop into our 20s or 30s, which was much later than was originally thought.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, most people thought that the brain stops developing in childhood, but we now know it stops. It continues to develop right throughout adolescence and into the 20s and even the 30s. So the development of the brain goes on for much longer than most neuroscientists ever believed.
And what does that, I mean, we've been talking and focusing obviously on the adolescent nature of this, but what does that mean for someone in their 20s and 30s?
Well, I mean, there is an argument made recently in the medical journals that adolescents should be considered to go up to about 24 years old. So that's one possibility, that we kind of reconsider the whole definition of adolescence. So it's not just the teenage years, but it goes on longer than that. And that's partly based on the new brain science showing that the brain continues to change right into the 20s. I think what it means, I mean, it's hard to know really, but I think it probably means that the ability to learn and the sum of evidence for creativity is heightened right into the 20s, like throughout childhood, as we all knew, and in the teenage years and in the 20s compared with later on.
When it comes to your research and your science, as you say, some of these are relatively young fields. What are the big question marks that are still out there that you would like to answer?
Oh, there are so many. Okay, I'll just give you a couple of examples.
Sure.
I'm interested in individual differences. So, of course, there's no such thing really as an average teenager. All teenagers are different, just like all adults are different. And understanding more about individual differences in brain development, I think, is the next big question. Like, you know, how does the brain develop in different cultures or in different socioeconomic groups, or if you have different levels of nutrition or in different education environments or with different, I don't know, if you smoke cannabis or drink alcohol, all those environmental influences, how do they affect the way the brain develops during adolescence, I think is a really important question. Another question, of course, which is related, is how does technology and screen time affect the developing brain? Because there's a lot of worry that it's having a negative effect on the developing brain of teenagers. But we don't actually know yet because the science hasn't been done. It is starting to be done, but there are no answers yet. One thing about screen time is that whether or not it affects their brain in negative or positive ways, I think it certainly has an effect on sleep. If young people, as a lot of young people I work with tend to do, they tend to have their cell phones on all night and responding to messages in the middle of the night, which is waking them up, and that clearly can't be good for sleep. And we all know that sleep is so important for mood and mental health and well-being.
Sarah Jane Blakemore is a professor of cognitive neuroscience at University College London. Her book is called Inventing Ourselves, The Secret Life of the Teenage Brain. She spoke with the Best of Our Knowledge's Joe Donahue. Still to come, some changes in the brain can result from trauma, physical or otherwise. That story's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Before we start this next story, here's a quick warning. This piece deals with the aftermath of childhood sexual trauma. Traumatic events can physically change the brain. For people who suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder, those changes are significant. But therapies that focus on the mind-body connection can help survivors reverse some of those changes. Lee Romney brings us the story of one woman who is working at that every single day.
I've had some tightness in my chest. My stomach keeps flipping and flopping.
Jenny Wiley wants nothing more than to be fully present, to be in the here and now. Sometimes that's nearly impossible. Take May 1st.
I don't like when I feel like I can't focus on things because every little noise and every little creak makes it seem like something's coming.
The intense anxiety, the sense of danger, it passes. But a few days later, Jenny finds herself overcome again.
It's May 3rd, 6 o'clock in the morning. I had a really bad nightmare that woke me up. I felt like I was suffocating.
Jenny's 44, and her brain thinks yesterday is now. The part that responds to danger is always revved up. And little things, like a smell or a gesture, can immediately bring back the past. That means old traumas, or the feelings associated with them, return vividly with full-fledged panic, even when she's with her wife, who she trusts more than anyone.
One time we were, like, playful, wrestling. Everything went black. I started screaming. My hands were out in front of me, eyes closed. I was back in the past, trying to shove a person off of me that I could not shove off of me.
This happened more than once, and for Jenny's wife, Nancy Wiley, it was hard.
I would say that it hurt, you know, when something like that would happen, because I'd be like, you know, it's me, and she'd be standing there with her hands up in the air going, no, 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 don't touch me, get away, and she'd be like far, far away. But eventually I would then go into therapist mode, and I'd be like, honey, it's all right, you know, we're here in our house.
In her professional life, Nancy's actually a trauma therapist. But at home, she's a loving partner. Keeping those roles separate has taken some navigating.
My heart breaks all the time for Jenny. It always broke for my clients, but I never knew we were going to have this in our relationship.
Jenny and Nancy live in a country clapboard house that they designed on a dead-end street next to 60 acres of wooded trails. They painted it a color they call lesbian lavender. For a while, everything seemed fine.
And then just like that, the flashbacks started. Flashbacks during the day, flashbacks in the evening, nightmares all night.
Nightmares of being crushed, of being choked, of being sexually assaulted, just trying to get away, and not ever being able to get away.
Not everyone who experiences trauma winds up with PTSD, but those who do undergo pretty dramatic brain changes. Stress hormones course through the body long after danger has passed. So the amygdala, which governs emotions like fear, shows up on brain scans as hyperactive. Other, more advanced parts of the brain are smaller than they should be, like the one that helps us order our memories so we can tell past from present. Jenny's PTSD is linked to sexual abuse. She says it started when she was about 4. She survived by checking out, a coping skill that robbed Jenny of lots of memories.
We had these doorknobs at my house that looked like diamonds. And I would hyper-focus on that diamond doorknob. And in each of the pieces of the diamond, I could see little pieces of myself. So then I'm completely focused on this fractured me. There were just times when I would just go completely black.
Jenny says she always struggled with anxiety and depression, but she functioned well. She raised a daughter. She loved her job as library director for the Cape Cod village of Kituit. But after a difficult series of miscarriages a few years ago, she said, her coping skills just stopped working. One Thursday in May 2016, it got to be too much.
I wanted to be dead, and I had been hearing a voice that kept saying my name over and over. That day, it was a white extension cord, and I was walking out to the backyard, the tree out there, when I noticed where I was, and I knew then what I was headed to do.
She just walked straight in and straight to my office. She didn't say, hi, how you doing, nothing. She said, I'm going to kill myself today, and I need you to do something. And I said, okay, I will. She was just balled up and terrified of the world, and it was really heartbreaking.
Nancy found inpatient trauma treatment for Jenny in Arizona. There, she learned that she had PTSD, how it had morphed her brain, and what she could do to try to change it again for the better. She takes medication and sees an old-school psychoanalyst. She's also turned to therapies that help her smell, hear, and see what's around her now.
It's May 3rd, 6:30. I'm getting ready to do some grounding yoga. There's one bird. It keeps sounding like it's saying, yoo-hoo, yoo-hoo. It's a little bit like that little piece of me that knows how to make myself feel better for the rest of the day.
After a month in Arizona, Jenny returned to Cape Cod. She felt like she'd spent a lifetime faking it. She was ready to find her true self. She took her first trip abroad to India with a good friend. They started a travel blog. Jenny's written 2 children's books, and she quit her job at the library, all to focus on getting better. This is Monday Therapy with a trauma specialist. She helps the adult Jenny, the one who's no longer in danger, keep a toehold in the present while processing the past. That pulsing wave machine, that's so no one outside the room can hear.
I'm little because I have one of those sundresses that have the little matching bloomers.
What does she believe her value is?
Nothing. She doesn't believe she's alive.
Her eyes look dead.
You want to hold the buzzers?
The buzzers. Those are for eye movement desensitization and reprocessing, or EMDR. Jenny takes one in each hand. They buzz. Left, right. Left, right. That activates both sides of her brain and somehow helps her take old memories and move them into the past. She does it by changing her story. That little girl with the dead eyes, Jenny's about to put her somewhere safe.
She's on a swing set. In a backyard.
Mm-hmm.
She's swinging. The rocking helps. The rocking helps. That's why I rock.
The therapist suggests they leave that vision of the little girl safe on her swing. So eventually, she and the adult Jenny, the one who's no longer under threat, can integrate and become one.
Where's that?
Oh, that's nice.
2.5 hours from here.
Oh, that's close, too.
Mm-hmm.
That's nice.
Yeah, it's...
Back home, Nancy and Jenny sit together on the sofa and look at property online. Nancy's trying to take better care of herself now, too, so they're both kind of in sync.
That's not bad, right?
They're thinking of scaling down one day, buying some land in western Massachusetts, building a cabin, and raising some chickens.
Yeah. 7 acres.
Oh, man, we could do a lot in 7 acres.
19,000.
Jenny's been having fewer flashbacks. She's hopeful, but she knows she has to work hard to manage her symptoms every day.
Today is May 8th, so I'm going to read this mantra.
She still has to constantly tell her brain...
I'm centered.
...and body...
I'm grounded.
...that the fierce sense of danger is yesterday's news.
I am safe. I am safe.
In Barnstable, Massachusetts, I'm Lee Romney.
According to the National Center for PTSD, about 7 or 8 out of every 100 people will experience PTSD at some point in their lives. Women are more likely to develop the condition than men, and genes may make some people more likely to develop PTSD than others. Okay, so who exactly is more likely to develop PTSD? That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
What makes some more susceptible to PTSD? I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities, and today on the Academic Minute, Philip Zolads, associate professor of psychology at Ohio Northern University, looks into this question.
Individuals who are exposed to trauma are at risk for developing post-traumatic stress disorder, or PTSD. One of the cardinal symptoms of PTSD is a powerful, often intrusive memory of the traumatic event. This memory can prompt the onset of flashbacks and motivate PTSD patients to avoid stimuli that remind them of their trauma. Although the traumatic memory is often considered an enhanced memory that is easily accessible, it can actually be fragmented and difficult to consciously recall. Only a subset of traumatized individuals experience prolonged symptoms that warrant a diagnosis of PTSD. Thus, there is interest in identifying factors that make select individuals more susceptible to developing PTSD-like phenotypes following trauma exposure. We have been using a basic science model in healthy individuals to examine factors that influence emotional memory formation, which could provide insight into who is more likely to develop traumatic memories and potentially PTSD. In our model, participants are exposed to a brief 3-minute stressor, after which they are given a learning task. We previously found that stressing participants immediately or 30 minutes before learning enhanced or impaired long-term memory respectively. Thus, we predicted that some individuals may be more susceptible to these effects. Recent work testing this hypothesis revealed that our previously observed stress-induced alterations of memory were greatly amplified in individuals who retained variants of genes coding for stress response proteins, such as receptors for cortisol and noradrenaline. We also found that females are relatively resistant to stress-induced impairments of memory and may be more susceptible to stress-induced enhancements of memory. We are currently following up this work by examining how these genetic variants and sex influence the extinction of fear memories, a process that is essential to exposure therapy but often impaired in PTSD patients.
That was Philip Zolads of Ohio Northern University. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. And you can find us on Twitter at TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.